Good evening. I'm here to talk for like 10 minutes, maybe 15, about 2012 budget. Just introductory. Tonight we'll be talking about the general fund, the other funds, you know, street, water, debt service, enterprise funds, water, sewer, storm, are in pretty good shape. We'll get definitive on those. But tonight we'll talk about general fund. Strategy-wise, we're looking at kind of a, for 2012, kind of a same level of revenues as 2011 this year. I'll admit the robust recovery that I predicted a year ago ain't going to happen in October of this year. It's probably at least 2 years out. So for 2012 in the general fund, we're looking just flatlining the revenues. One exception, the Grandview annexation, we'll put 12 grand in extra sales tax for that AMPM. That's what the county's getting, according to Steve Oliver and the treasurer. So that'd be a plus, and the sales tax is small plus. But just to kind of refresh, for this year's performance on revenues, we sent out the revenue graphs, but I'll just briefly go through. Property tax, we're ahead. Sales tax, we're ahead. It looks pretty good, actually, about 21 grand ahead on sales tax through August, 8 months. Utility tax is right on, a little bit over. And that was kind of interesting because we were lower on utility tax, and I noticed we got quite a few bucks on the first, second, third of the month on cell tax, cell phone. So I called those folks and said, "You're late. We have penalties we could assess, so get them here earlier." And by God, they did, which was kind of cool. So we caught up on our utility tax for the year. Our residential commercial permits, we're still under quite a bit, although the residential side and the building department side is very strong. Single-family residents, the thing we're hurting on is infrastructure, inspection of infrastructure and development review revenues. So there's just not a lot going on that way in terms of new housing developments, new commercial developments.
Going back to your utility tax that you just talked about.
Yeah.
Cell phone versus landline, is the tax the same? Or?
Yeah, 6%, yeah, the limit, yeah.
Okay, so if people give up their landline in lieu of their phone, cell phone, there's no change other than the fact.
Less revenue for the city?
Well, yeah. I'm saying, you know, kind of some people are getting cell phones instead of landlines.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
And so I just wondered if there was a tax difference to the city.
Same rate. But okay. But I would say we have noticed our landline utility tax money go down and cell phone go up over the last few years. Sure. You see that trend.
Mark, fresh memory on cell phone towers. Is there any income along that line?
We get rental, yeah, annual rental.
Is that put into the utility fund? Or?
It's in the general fund, like in tonight's monies we're talking about. It's not a lot of money, but yeah.
About three of them, four of them down?
I don't know how many we got. I think there's two different cell phone
we don't get
providers.
We own the land.
Yeah, we're renting the land. There's one up on Thornton, the park right by our water tank. So the residential commercial permits aside, the single-family residential permitting side is strong. The infrastructure inspection is low. So next year we're just going to go off this year's kind of level and not predict any growth for 2012. I think that's the prudent thing. We're mired in a recession, as you all know, and I don't see us poking our heads up for at least 2 years, 2014. Traffic mitigation is fees are quite a bit below budget, but it's kind of made up by the real estate excise tax fees are quite a bit above budget. Those are used for road and building projects. And I guess the latest change in the state law, we can use it for maintenance as well. Plus, we get from 6 to 10 years now to spend our traffic mitigation monies. We usually have no trouble spending it within the 6 years. Water sewer combined. That enterprise funds is looking very healthy, so that's a good thing. Solid waste tax is creeping up to very close to the budgeted revenue line. We're within 25 grand, 3%. So we're just the thought process is just hold that line, repeat for 2012 what we think 2011 is going to come in at. you know, every month. We got 8 months worth now. You get 9 months, 10 months, you feel a little more secure. But we'll pump up sales tax just a little bit for the annexations, and perhaps property tax a little bit for the annexations. One of the real challenges in the general fund all over, but especially general fund, is health insurance. Our health insurance premiums for medical insurance is predicted to go up 11%, 5% on dental, 6% on vision. That comes to almost $71,000 just in the general fund for those increases. You know, we isolated that. That's just a kind of a big challenge we're facing. So our preliminary numbers, and we will present to you a balanced budget tonight. It is not balanced. We'll show you where we are in terms of our general fund. So we'll pass these out. Greg, if you can take. Let me kind of just jump to the second page.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When you talked about medical insurance and stuff, what percentage does do the employees pay into that or any? Or I know that's a big hot issue now with a lot of city governments, is getting their employees to pay more.
Right. I believe all employees pay some, and we have, you'll entertain tonight a contract. Those are being markedly increasing for 2012, but in spite of that, in spite of those increasing, I'll call them premium shares, the total increase for general fund net of those, again, is it's pretty close to $71,000.
Do you recall what the percent increase was last year? It was a pretty big jump.
It's 11% on medical last year as well, or 10.5. It turned out to be 10.5 on medical. You know, maybe the 11% will come down a bit. We'll get the final numbers in the next 2 months, but I got to go with what they're telling us. They gave us an email that here's what you should use. Yo.
I think you mentioned a few months ago that a major cause of the increases was that we now are required to cover college-age beneficiaries, the children. They're up to 26 years old, something like that. Do you recall that?
That's certainly part of it. We have just a few instances of that in our folks. Not too many, but that's part of it. Yep. Page 2 of the handout for the general fund, if you look at the lower right-hand corner, is just hone in on that. There's a negative $133,000. So we are, at this point, in the hole, $133,000 for 2012. We'll continue to work on that. We might be able to gain a little bit more in the revenues as the revenues come in, maybe inch up sales tax a bit, but not very much. So our challenge is looking at cutting costs to make this thing balance for 2012. So I won't go through a whole lot of detail here. We have included in this packet.
Quick question, yep. Mark. I noticed a 3% increase for the fire district contract.
That's my assumption.
Has the chief given you any figures at all yet?
No, I just saw him the other day. I said, how's your knees? He jumped up and down, said they were good. That's all we talked about is knee replacements.
So it would not be unbelievable that we could think 3% the next January get something different.
Oh, yeah, it'll be different. I guarantee it'll be different. It could be higher or lower. It probably won't be 3%. You know, I've factored into these numbers knowns. Like, we have a known contract. Goes through 2012 for the office union, public works union, a 3.5% increase. That's in here. It's in the contract. I put in here the anticipated percent increase for the police guild, which you'll see tonight. That's favorable for 2012.
But the fire district contract, one of the reasons we got hit last year was that there were major reevaluations that went on out in the county as opposed to in the city.
Yeah, especially so, the
big hit,
industries.
80,000, whatever that was.
150,000.
60,000 extra. Was it 150?
150 over my budgeted increase.
Over.
It was big.
That's already happened. And yes. You've already calculated that in.
We're paying it this year, yeah.
So the likelihood of taking another big hit due to devaluations out of the county, because that's a balanced thing. What the fire district could do that would really mess us up is take some of their bank capacity.
I don't know what their strategy is.
I don't either, but that's where they could mess us up.
I thought I'd better go in at 3% increase. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it could go down, but I'm not going to go with a lower figure. It could go down. The county assessor told me, Keith Wilnar told me, that every 6 years he looks at 1/6 of the county in more detail. And he said Ferndale is going to get the more detailed look in 2011 for 2012 taxes. So it could be that within the city limits, our assessed value goes down some more than it did last year, 4.4% reduction in assessed value for city, within city limits. So it can happen. And as the refineries expand and add more value, I don't know how much it's going to hit for 2012, but they're definitely expanding, at least one of them is. That can help us as far as the fire district math and the bill. So this is preliminary, but we're still working on the cost side to get this thing balanced up. Nothing new in here. Nothing new. No capital purchases. Nothing new. Yes.
Thank you, Mark. Can we assume, or maybe I shouldn't, but I guess I would think that the library sink fund that we created, that would be out of solid waste?
Yes.
That's covered there.
It is. And it's one of those other 42 funds that has that in there already.
It's not impacting the general fund at all.
Correct. Well, maybe indirectly, but yeah. We're planning on making those sinking payments as if we did bonds this year.
This is probably more of a question for Greg. The land purchase of Washington Vista, is that still pending?
Yeah, it's still pending. The purchase and sale agreement has been prepared and sent off to the landowner. We're waiting for them to sign it and return. I called last week. I left a message on their voicemail, but I haven't heard back.
You have this number 65 on the system.
Yeah, that's why I was asking that. If it showed up here on there.
Yeah.
Is it 93,000 down, and then that's the balance? 2012, the final year for it?
No. It's
3 years?
Yeah, 3 years of 20,000 each.
Our total price of that property was?
Was 150.
Let me just point out page 7, then we'll move on to a different handout. Page 7 is kind of something new. This is the general fund cash position versus our intended reserve target. And this is the same kind of numbers we give the bond brokers when we do a general obligation bond issue. They want to know how much reserve do you have, what is your policy, how much are you supposed to have in the general fund. General fund for our audited financial statements combines our actually general fund, the various facilities, capital reserve, contingency reserve, left one fund, and lastly, solid waste act. So you combine all those five fund numbers into something called the general fund. Right-hand column, our forecasted cash balance is $1,292,000 in this scenario, and our reserves goal is $1,634,000. So, we have work to do in terms of balancing that general fund budget, and that will affect the cash balance, obviously. But whether we go out for general obligation bonds in 2012, and the only candidate that I know of is perhaps the library general obligation, but who knows if we're really ready for that. We want to issue bonds if we're ready to build. I don't think we're not ready to build today, and I don't know if we will be mid-2012. I kind of doubt it with the fundraising. Yep.
Can you direct me to the left one fund? I'm sure it's right in front of me here.
Yeah, let's see. Where did I put that? It's on page 5.
Okay, and so you project 248 at the end of 2012.
2011.
Yeah, 300 grand at the end of 2012.
I'm looking at the left one, police retiree, 704, end of 2012, 248.
Oh, the bottom one.
Oh, that's the beginning balance. Way at the bottom right-hand corner.
Okay.
We're putting 100 grand a year in from solid waste.
And do you have an opinion as to what it should be?
Yeah, I do. It should be $6 million. cash balance. I've done the math.
A little bit behind.
I've done the math. Now, the state actuary has a program, which I've used, plugged in the numbers, plugged in the age of our three officers, and that only came up to like $700,000 or $800,000 that we should have in the bank. And but their assumptions are really off, I believe. They've got a interest or the inflation rate on medical insurance about 7.5%, going down to 5% over the years. And their investment interest assumption is like 5.5% or 6%. We're getting less than 0.25% right now. And I've used higher figures for the cost of medical care. So I think my numbers are better. So it's a big number.
It is a big number.
We're paying as you go. We're not required to disclose this anywhere. But when you do the bonds, they ask, well, what's your obligation on left three? They know all about left one and how much money you got in there toward it. They know all about those obligations, even though they're not on our financial statements. So they ask about it.
Are the left one retirees, when they pass 62 or 65, required to offset with Medicare?
Yes.
So our obligation is for the supplement and anything extra?
Yes. We have one, I believe, that's over 65. We pay a different medical insurance premium to whoever we do it with. Yeah.
If your prediction of $6 million is correct,
yes,
that wouldn't all get hit in the same budget. That would
spread
over a number.
It's spread over then your dollars and then de-escalated to today's dollars. How much should we have in the bank that only collects like 1% interest? Pay this thing off until age 86. Which after that, I assume, is nothing more. Rather macabre, but...
Do you have any ice balls?
Let me hand out another thing. I'm taking one of those.
All right. We got five. Let's wrap this up. So, Mark, I just want to say, we have 5% of what you think we should have, if my math is correct.
What is that?
In that fund.
$300,000, 5%. Yeah, exactly. By the end of next year, we'll have 5% of what we should have. But the auditors are okay as long as we make progress in building that fund balance each year. So we're throwing $100,000. What's that?
And nobody gets sick.
So far, they're pretty healthy.
Yeah.
I see all the bills. They get dollar for dollar. There's a cap on dental.
Is this a property tax?
No cap on medical.
But the other thing that's a crapshoot is the worst thing that can happen would be for one of them to go to a nursing home.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then have major medical kinds of issues as well as
right.
The nursing home cost. If, God forbid, but if they were to die of a heart attack overnight,
we'd be looking better.
Yeah.
Now, we explored getting key person life insurance a few years ago. But that would require us to get cooperation from these three individuals for a physical. We didn't think we'd get the cooperation from everybody. It's a little macabre to talk about it. But this handout is just shows kind of what if. You know, the last 2 years we've had a 0% property tax increase. You know, this year we've got $71,000 in medical insurance. Is it 3 years? 0%. This shows what we've done since 2007 in terms of Joe Blow or Joe Sixpack that owns a $250,000 house, what he's paid in property tax and water sewer bills. Just kind of combining those because that's kind of the hit to everybody here. And you can see down below the monthly charge. This is a 12-unit average water user every 2 months and then property tax for a $250,000 home. So. You know, we substantially did increase water sewer rates in 2008. We needed to get on a solid financial footing, be able to pay for all the capital items and the comp plans. And then you can see the property tax as well, gone from 264 to 295. You know, and actually that same $250,000 house is probably not assessed at that these days. It may go down next year, so they pay a little less tax, but. Overall, this is kind of gives you a look at...
Why would they pay less tax if all the homes go down?
If their valuation went down?
Yeah, but if all the valuations have gone down, the...
We don't budget on a percentage. We budget on dollars.
We always have some new construction assessed value come in. Now, overall, in 2011,
that's the only thing
it did go down.
Yeah, but
overall,
if there is no new construction or no new annexation or like that,
yeah, you're right.
If all houses went up or down the same,
yeah,
it doesn't change property tax.
And we didn't change our take on how what percentage increase. We had no increase, and if that was the only thing on the bill, by golly, you're right.
Or
put the same dollar.
If my house is worth half as much, but so is everybody else's house, my taxes are still the same.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We always have some new construction, and annexation will help us, too, the new annexation values that come in.
New construction and annexation does not count against us.
No, it doesn't.
In terms of the number of dollars that we collect. If we collect $1 million on, let's say, $1 billion worth of evaluation, and that billion becomes $500 million, forget the new construction and annexation, we're going to still collect $1 million
yes.
on that. It's just the rate changes, but the amount doesn't.
Right. But we collect more with new houses built.
Exactly.
And annexation.
Yep. Yep. So I guess any questions on this kind of spreadsheet? Property tax has grown from 464 to 295 over those years, and then the total monthly bill, 96 to 126.
Well, what I wanted Mark to do and ask him just, I wanted to know, okay, taking a $250,000 home, that was kind of average, what does the city of Ferndale mean to each homeowner? So since 2007, going all the way into 2012, we've increased the bill to the average homeowner by $29.56 per month. Is what it equals. So that's the increase from $96.61 to $126.17. So a lot of the increases, when you see people say my monthly bill has increased, you go, well, a lot of that has nothing to do with City of Ferndale. City of Ferndale hasn't increased your rates.
Kind of
an interesting number.
The net total in the 2007 property tax utilities total $11.59. You've kind of added everything up there. And then next year it'll be $15.14. So kind of the net impact of city decisions is, $400? $350, something like that? It's too much math for me. $450.
Yeah, per year. Or monthly
per
times
year.
12, you get the same answer. Yeah.
Per year.
The thing I was going to point out is as you look at this, if this were your telephone bill, you would probably see a bigger hit, or your cell phone bill, or your electricity bill, or your gas bill. They've all had this kind of increase, and we're the ones that they are local to. So they come after the guys that could sit here and get on the microphone and yell at. But the same increases have occurred to all other utilities. It may be higher or lower, but when you average them out, I would guess that $29 that per month, I certainly think my utility bills have gone up more than $29 over the last 7 years a month.
Yeah.
Especially telephone.
Yeah, and that's what I came. $39 a month is what we're paying more per month in 12 as in 07. I subtracted the $11.59 from the $15.14 and came up with $355 and divide that by 12.
$29.56. Wait, go down $126 minus $96.61 is $29.56. So it's $29.56 per month.
Difference between 2007 and 2012.
Yeah, the math works. I got to wrap it up and turn it over to these guys, to Burke. We'll keep working on it. Get your balanced budget very soon. No.
Okay, give this your
break.
Show.
No, this budget.
Good evening, council members. My name is Morgan Shook. I've been in front of you guys about a little over a month ago, chatting a little bit about the Main Street Planned Action EIS and the city's look at an infrastructure funding strategy. I'm here with my colleague, Jay Rogers. We work at BERT. We're a public policy consultancy. Both Jay and I specialize in working with cities in Washington on a range, I would say, economic development, real estate, infrastructure financing, and tax policy issues. And so the city's engaged us to take a look at, basically, I think it boils down to what a public-private partnership may look like, potentially, depending on how the work goes, in helping move forward the planned action and development within the area, what would be known as the Main Street planned action area, under, of course, the city's terms, what may work for the city. So today what I wanted to do was basically talk a little bit about what our project is and where we're going to kind of get you oriented around what we see as being the big issues and the things that you're going to have to grapple with in the coming weeks based on our work, and allow you some opportunity to ask us questions and provide some feedback and directions, specifically how we can address some of your concerns through our work going forward. So today, you know, discussion, go ahead, feel free to interrupt anytime. I'll just kind of use this to kind of walk us through a little bit of what we're doing and how to think about the issues. So with that, any questions before I get started? Okay. All right. So if you just kind of look at the map, this area here, I think is the way we've been known, oriented around it. The Main Street Planned Action EIS area has really kind of got four quadrants. One quadrant already has some development on it. Potentially likely also would be the home of future developments. You see now it has some considerable momentum. It's the smallest in terms of additional capacity, with the other three sort of quadrants providing a lot more sort of built capacity, but at the same time, the nature of what may go there and how much is somewhat uncertain. And so kind of the way we want to think about this going forward, there are potentially some deals and some things that we know more about in the most immediate side, so things that the city be contemplating about. Does it make sense for us to be supporting this from a financial or community perspective way versus how we might think about the entire project going? So basically the EIS laid out anywhere from basically the no action, just chugging along at maybe 300,000 square feet of commercial space upwards to potentially $1.2 million. All those different amounts of development are going to trigger different needs for projects. And so the question is how basically do different levels of development necessitate different levels of projects, and can development pay for all those pieces in terms of making it go forward? Or are they potentially looking at the city to potentially help out that? And ultimately the question to you, is that a good bet to be making? So just to kind of recap sort of, you know, kind of three questions that we're really going to be taking a look at. And so the first one is really that this area through the EIS has identified a number of sort of needs, both on sort of the general public service side of things, so police, potentially other road maintenance kind of issues. But the largest potential sort of investments are going to be needed on the transportation side. And there are sort of current estimates that could be ranged in the tens of millions of dollars, of which, you know, which caused some people to balk at a little bit on the development side, being sort of unfeasible to place on the development in those areas. And so the first thing to take a look at is actually under state law and SEPA, you know, what is sort of the fair share, the fair and equitable share that development should pay in order to, you know, mitigate its impacts in that area, and for us to do some sensitivity analysis. So hypothetically, you're thinking about, say $20 million worth of projects there, and development has its fair share of being able to cover roughly $10 million of that. You're still left with another $10 million worth of projects that are likely to be mitigated, and the city needs a strategy in order to figure out how to make that go forward. And that's principally where we want to focus in on. So if you start with mitigation and you say, well, how do you basically test those things, and how do you get that number as large as possible so that the amount the city may be needed to cover is as small as possible, then the question is, what's the right way, and how valuable are these projects to the city? And what is the right way to get that funding into the projects in order to make them go happen? So if we took a step back and said, you know, how do cities typically look at sort of these sort of market-making projects? So, you know, if I had to tell a brief history of this, you know, certain landowners in the area recognize that there's an opportunity here to serve local markets on the retail side of things, and has come forward and asked the city for some level of regulatory support, of which you guys have been working with the city on the planned action EIS to to provide a certain level of certainty, changes in zoning that allow the type of development that they're seeking to do. The second question then has come up through that process is obviously the need for potentially large investments in infrastructure. And so the question has been extended to you guys as saying not only do you need to support the project from a regulatory point of view, but potentially there might be a need for you to support the project from a financial point of view. And so for us, it's really to try to the question before us and what we're doing our work is really understanding what is the value of the project to the city. And I think this is kind of dovetails nicely with the conversation you just had with Mark, is that the city has existing sort of fiscal sustainability challenges, and that the city is not interested in plowing all the benefits of the project right back into the project. So once you understand what the value of that is, of the entire project to the city in terms of financially, from all the different taxes that it's going to generate, what number is the right number to be thinking about investing in? Is it's probably some number less than the total value of the projects. And so the way our work is going to go forward is really to take a look at the first part, in the different forms of developer mitigation. So, you know, what could development bear? What is the, you know, under the statutory limitations of Washington State law and CEPA, how might you might construct potentially the right types of impacts and load the amount of those costs onto development, whether it be through transportation impact fees, through CEPA mitigation or other forms? You know, what can these developments bear that doesn't make the land too expensive for them to develop on? And that's a fine art to understand what it is. It's not simply just when does the project not pencil. When does the project not pencil here versus somewhere else? I mean, you're not. This is not the only development opportunity. So it's kind of a fine line to ride, but that's something we're going to be taking a look at. But it's, and there's some rough approximations you can say, but there's also a lot of sort of state law to say this is what's fair and right. So,
where do you go about getting all that information?
Well, we
all in private hands, and it's some developers have deeper pockets than others. And
exactly, and so you're constrained by two things. So the first thing constrained is just the law, you know, that that there's a proportionality of the impact to the fee that you can charge, and typically that establishes the lower bound. But we can also do some sort of off-sheet calculations just so you can understand what the deal looks like. So you can just model it on a pro forma basis and say, you know, if you're assuming this type of development and we know roughly kind of what they generate in terms of sales, we can look at comparables throughout the state and say, you know, this is what the land rents are likely to generate, this is what the land is being bought for, this is what we think the land is worth. You can make some approximations for what their sort of return on investments and equity are going to be just based on sort of norms that are in the real estate market right now. So you can kind of understand from their perspective what the deal looks like. But you're right, everybody's a little different, and everybody's willing to have different tolerances there. But I think it's good just to kind of understand that from your from the city's perspective, how they are thinking about the deal. Because once you show that, too, they can say, well, that's not what our deal looks like. And you're like, okay, what does your deal look like? You know? So I think that's part of the discussion when you get to developer mitigation. But I don't want to play on that too much because I think it's an important thing to understand, but it's not really going to be the critical thing because I think you're really more bounded on the CEPA side of things and saying this is your fair share because, you know, if they're from their perspective, why would I pay more than I'm legally bound to? Unless I really, 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 really want it.
Is there sort of like a tipping point for developers that we're trying to find?
Exactly. I think.
I mean, it's not an exact tipping point, but there's a place where they say, the heck we do Ferndale.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we want to know where that tipping point is because we want to get as close to it as we can, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's what you're going for.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things we're doing for you.
That's a big
I think that's where we're starting. You know, I think you want to say, like, we got this big pot of money, this big jar we're trying to take collections from in order to do these projects. We want to fill up the jar there first before we start looking at other places. So if there's a sort of sequencing about where the money should come from, it's with starting there with the developer side of things. And your tools there are fairly limited, but they're also pretty good tools in terms of sort of saying this is what it is. And so you can kind of calibrate that. So what does the law say we can do? What do we think the number is? And are we testing in the right place? Okay. So
question along
sure.
that line. If we come up with, in other jurisdictions, I don't know, you've done this other places, if we come up with a dollar amount, say, okay, Mr. Box, we're going to charge you $10. And does it end up getting into negotiations where they come back and say, no, we want $5? And then we say, well, no, how about $8.50? Yeah.
So, yeah,
or do they just say, you know, we say 10, and they're thinking 5, they just get up and walk away from the table and you have no...
Cities do negotiate that. So this, the thing about the planned action that's different than what we typically look at is just simply project-specific things. Like, I'm a developer, I've got this thing I want to put in. We've done a project-specific EIS or these impacts, but the city wants to partner with it, so we'll give these things. And so that negotiation, typically through a development agreement, is a little more easy to do. With the planned action, it's going to be a little differently because what you're doing is basically looking at every project. And so you're building the right sort of framework that not just one project, but all projects need to play by. So the amount, the ability to sort of negotiate on a project-specific basis is a little more limited. So that's kind of why you need to think about sort of this question I brought about certainty. You know, what do you know might be more likely in the near term versus how do you might want to think about all the uncertain stuff, all the other development that's going to take place and some of the stuff on the east side of I-5. So that's a critical thing. But typically, you know, what we've done with these things is we do our analysis and we'll say this is the right number, and you know, and either get up and say that's too much, but there is some room for negotiation there typically in these conversations. But that's really one that the city can choose to handle in a way that it thinks is best for the city. So is that distinction clear on the EIS side of things? The sort of the sense that you're not really looking at just one project, but potentially, you know, tens, you know.
So what we have to come up with is basically then what I'm understanding is that kind of an overall.
Exactly. What's so an example?
So it may be beneficial for this guy over here. Say, hey, this is a good deal for me, but this guy over here may not be as, you know.
Yeah. So you're not. Yes. Yeah, so you're not able to. You're looking at sort of more of a structural way. We know that there are sort of these amount of impacts related to this amount of growth, but you don't know really what the growth looks like and how it's going to come on board. Maybe 100,000 square foot here, 10,000 here, you know, 50,000 here, and they're all going to trigger different types of things. So like the transportation impact fee, you have the ability potentially to structure a different impact fee process for the city, for the and within the EIS area. You can get differential rates, and depending on, and you can proportion it on any metric that you would choose. Most times it's trips, but you can also potentially do like on a square footage basis. So those are types of different mitigation you can think about. Because you know ultimately what the end point is. We need to get to $10 million to pay for these projects at this level of development. And so everybody who comes on is all paying that piece. It's all a little lumpy. And so maybe you're ahead a little bit, maybe you're a little behind from the city's point of view. But ultimately when you get there, you're hopefully those things are balanced. And so this is kind of why this is more of a strategy, because you've got to say we don't know what the future is. With this planned action, we said we want to be open for economic development. We want to provide more certainty, more expedited permit review. Those are all good things for the city, especially for an interchange area here. But sort of the downside of that is that you don't really know what the projects look like. And so you got to sort of say, God, so we forecasted out all this, you know, potentially 1.2 million square feet of retail, you know, or commercial activity, you know, but we don't know really what it looks like. And so, but we know that it triggers all these different projects. And so how do we build a consistent, thoughtful, and fair mitigation strategy on the development side that covers X amount of dollars of those projects? Okay. So once you kind of sort of tackle that first part, that the developer side of things, you're still, I mean, this is hypothetical. We don't know exactly what the strategy may look like in terms of how much that can cover. But assuming that there's some, and given the level of costs that have been floated that might be necessitated, it's likely that there will be some uncovered portion that the city will need to try to figure out how to accommodate if it chooses so under its terms. Like, you know, what are we trying to get out of this project? Are we hoping that this is going to help us address some of our long-term fiscal sustainability challenges? And then, you know, what amount do we really want to be thinking about supporting in the project? So our first point here is really to try to understand what the project's worth to the city. You know, so this is something we're working on currently, is taking different levels of development within the EIS area and sort of forecasting them forward. And so we're running lots of different scenarios so you can kind of see. Like, there's a scenario that says, let's say all that stuff gets built in the next 20 years, you know, equally through, you know, get equal amounts of development throughout. What does that look like to the city? You know, what's the upside on the financial side of things? What happens if very little happens? What if you know just a couple big, like one small box star happens in the next 5 years and things trickle on for the next 10? You know, what does that look like to the city? So you can kind of see what's the financial upside of potentially different levels of development. And you can contrast that to the potential different projects that are likely needed to fund. So maybe developer mitigation in the near term, if only a few things happen, there aren't many projects, and maybe developer mitigation can pay for those things. But in the long run, the city's going to need to generate a lot more capital in order to finance potentially other projects that are going to come on with development. So there's this set of sequencing. So you've got development going at one pace, and you've got projects coming on at another pace. And depending on how they happen, they might not always balance. So for the city, it's trying to understand what's the value like at different levels of development compared to the amount of cost. And so that's the thing we're working on right now, just so we can understand the nature of the challenge here for the city. It's not all these projects don't come on at once, all the revenues don't come out at once. But if you understand sort of the sensitivities and different configurations of development, you can better understand sort of what your challenge is in managing growth in the future and what your strategy may be for financing infrastructure in the area. Okay. So once we kind of understand the value side of the equation, it's really then starting to have having a conversation about how do you actually get money into the project. And if you look at sort of on page 8, there's really principally four ways that the city can get money into the project. And two of them are fairly limited and for most small cities, and especially limited now and likely to be going forward. And two of them are a little more sort of interesting things that we'll have to take a look at. So the first thing is usually when we do this with cities is, you have a project. Is there any room within your current, transportation or comprehensive or capital improvement program to shift funding around? So the money that you do have dedicated, could you use it to reprioritize projects to help you sort of pay for the projects in the area? And sort of our preliminary discussions analysis of this is likely not. And most of the funding is already dedicated. And of the projects that are going forward, most of them are actually already dedicated. The projects that are going forward, they already have dedicated funding to them. On the transportation side, it's likely like the Ferndale is like many cities its size. Without federal or outside state agency support, most large transportation projects actually don't get built. And so that situation is likely to be going forward in the future for the projects identified in the planned action EIS. So the second one is always kind of is tied to that a little bit, but funding through other public agency partnerships. So potentially this really refers to projects that involve WSDOT on the interchange. Through state funding policy over the last several years, most projects don't move up and down the WSDOT prioritization list without some form of local match and local support. And so at this point, the way I understand it is that WSDOT doesn't have a comprehensive sort of strategy for funding projects in this area. And currently the project that is listed here is pretty low on the prioritization list. So there's a challenge there about whether or not the city could partner with the state to move that project up. But that's a small detail we won't focus on right now. I want to kind of focus really on the next two pieces. Sorry.
On that point, by the way, we have an audience here. There are handouts up front on what he's talking about up front.
Right.
So a question I have, since so many of these larger projects do require state and federal funds, and we can't guarantee we get that funding, how do we go into negotiation with property owners and developers, especially if that's the deal killer? I mean, if we're expected on our side to do X amount, we can only do X amount because we're hoping for federal money, but we can't guarantee that. How do you then negotiate?
Yeah, so I think that's a challenge. So luckily there aren't that many projects the majority of the projects identified are pretty much on local roads. So they're ones that actually are under your control and that you would be funding primarily. If you get additional money to put forward to it, that's always a positive, and that's something the city always is looking for, looking at sort of other federal, state, or TIB monies to potentially support projects. So that's something you're always going to be doing. But I think our default position is the city's on the hook to fund all those local projects. When it comes to the interchange project, that's a special situation that we'll have to pay a little
most
different attention to.
An interchange.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the big part of the pie.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the pie, but depending on sort of where development happens, it may not be one of the first projects that needs to happen. So, it's one of those things like, where does it make sense for you as a city to be investing, and where does it not make sense for you to be investing? And so it could help you think about sort of where, as you make changes to this, where you want development, where it doesn't make sense to development because you have no strategy to take care of those things. Typically, when we work with cities and they think about sort of these sort of market-making projects, without investment from the public side of things, from a public-private partnership, the project does not happen. I'm not saying that's the case here, but potentially it could be, and that's a perspective that you might want to wear for a little bit to see how it fits. If that is the case, it then is goes back to that question about what's the value of it, and do I want to think about pulling forward those future dollars of and investing them now in capital projects and hoping that the long-term revenues coming out of that to pay for themselves. And so what many cities do is do basically back-of-the-envelope tax increment financing. And so if they believe to a certain degree that a project here makes sense for them and that they feel fairly certain that of the stream of revenues they're going to be coming out of it, are they willing to pledge some of those revenues in today's dollars to finance the projects they need?
Mr. Shook, basically this, the graph here, it's so
hypothetical.
Yeah, hypothetical.
Yeah.
It floats somewhere around 50-50.
I wouldn't say it floats around 50-50. Everything's a little different. And so it all
60-40, 80-20.
We will have that answer, but we don't know what it is yet.
Yeah. Again, depending on what you got going on, but yeah. You definitely have to come to the table with some sort of.
Exactly. Yeah, and it all kind of depends on sort of where that developer mitigation piece settles at. And so what are the right projects that match up with it?
Would his mitigation be then under private contribution?
Yes. Yeah, so when development pays its fair share of development costs that it's imposing on the city, whether it's transportation, police, fire, those things of that nature. Well, I should back up. And so what we're trying to take a look at when we say what's the value of the project, we're really trying to say what's the net value of the project. And so what are we netting out? So right now we're just looking at infrastructure. What would the city want to spend on infrastructure? So what do we need to net out? We need to net out, one, all the public service costs that might go with development. So potentially increases to staffing within the city. So if a certain amount of development is going to trigger the need for another police officer, is it going to also trigger more dollars that need to come out of the fire district contract? Those are costs we want to lump towards the development and say we're not going to count that value because it's a real, because that money needs to be spent on serving the area. We're also going to net out sort of some level of cannibalization. The market area is confined. It's limited. If new things come in, they're likely to potentially take spending from other places. And so we want to try to figure out what's the right amount to reduce that by. We have some experience with other cities that kind of understand depending on different types of developments. In this case, you have more sort of regionally oriented retail. And so you're not as leveraged in some sense because you're getting a bigger market area, but you're also taking some local spending. So those two things. You get some addition, but you also have to have some subtraction in there. So those are principally the two things we want to net out. We don't want to double count any of the value of the project that should be going somewhere else. So back to the point. So the cities typically use some form of tax increment financing. So that's one way you can think about it. The second thing, it all revolves around sort of new tax policy. So right now we're just basically looking at the city as it exists today under its current taxing policies and say if you continue those out in the future, what might it be? What happens if you change some of those things? What happens if you bumped up one of your utility taxes and said we're going to dedicate the revenue off of utility taxes in that area, which we think is roughly this amount of money, to projects? What if we wanted to create a local improvement district where we had a special benefit assessment on the land that we wanted to use that to help fund infrastructure? What if the city wanted to pursue a transportation benefit district where we used the sales tax measure to pay for those projects? So those are those kind of two things are kind of the strategies that are on the table that the city's going to want to take a look at. And it's really going to be a question about how much money does it get you? What are kind of the pros? What are the kind of the cons of implementation? And is it right for this type of project? And so we're just kind of been thinking about just the specific area, but you can't really divorce it from the city's larger sort of fiscal sustainability challenges. Right now its own CIP and TIP are limited. Is there room potentially in some of these mechanisms to help leverage these projects that might happen to do other projects in the city? And so that kind of gets to that bigger question I'm talking about, sort of when I say what's right for the city, it's like defining what that actually means. Not only do you, potentially get the projects, but you balance it in a fair way with development, but that you also actually accomplish other goals that you would not have otherwise. That maybe you fund a few more projects because of you did something here in your strategy, you're able to fund a few more projects in your transportation improvement program, or maybe you're able to close a gap in the general fund to allow sort of the city to provide better and more sort of current levels of service given our current situation. So where we are right now with the project is we've been working with the city over the last several weeks since we've been on contract, mostly just getting smart. But right now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of really kind of defining some of the things I talked about in terms of what's the need at different levels of development, what's the value at different levels of development, and potentially how might you think about what's the right share on the developer mitigation side of things, and how do you think about potentially a city investment in the project. So we'll be coming in the next several weeks with the city through their project team to sort of kind of test some of our preliminary analyses, and at those meetings we'll kind of figure out a schedule for coming back to you guys to present our work as it continues to evolve.
I know in one discussion, I don't know where it was something was mentioned of the idea of saying, well, gee, if we can expect $500,000 a year in new sales tax revenue, we can go out and borrow X number of, you know, use part of that to go out and borrow money. Are you going to be looking at anything like that?
Yeah, so when I say, when I talk about what's the value of the project, what we try to do is typically look at different types of scenarios. You look forward 20 years because, you know, that's what you would typically bond at. So what's a 20-year stream of cash, you know, revenues going forward? And if you brought those all back into current dollars and thought about, what does it cost the city to borrow money plus some risk premium? What's that value? So, at you know, $500,000 a year, you could get maybe you know, $11 million worth of net present value projects. You could do $11 million worth of projects or something like that. But that's one of the things we're taking a look at. But one of the things we're also taking a look at is that there's considerable risk with these projects because there's so much uncertainty related to the amount of development that's possible versus what may be anticipated in the near term, which is why we're taking a look at different levels of development. So we can kind of see how that picture changes, because depending on how much materializes, the answer in terms of how the city may look at it may be vastly different.
That's it. Another question, Shirley?
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Okay, Council, we're on break till 6 o'clock.
I've been seeing folks.
Thank you.
Okay.
I would rather put that on the ground than...
We're paying for this.
We have to finish one council meeting before
I like it. We're trying to get something done this year.
Good. Okay. Well, just have to open the bids. If the numbers up, just work with Mark. Be sure that the numbers fit. And if they make sense for a public works one,
two of my election for prediction were within a percent.
Yep.
Two out of the four.
Sam, she wants to sign up. Where's the sign up list?
Is that it?
Right there.
I'm out of graphic pen.
I got a pen. Okay. Good.
We're first.
Hi.
What are they doing here?
Really? Are we demanding something? Are we complaining? Are we?
Go ahead.
You'll find out.
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. You may be seated.
Okay, before we have the clerk take the roll call, I want to introduce a person that's kind of lurking behind us. Council on Public, I introduce our new deputy clerk, Marcy Cool. And so welcome her to the city.
I think that's welcome back.
Okay, now our clerk will take the roll call.
Councilmember Malpez.
Here.
Councilmember Hansen.
Here.
Councilmember Ingram.
Here.
Councilmember Lester.
Here.
Councilmember Zimmerman.
Here.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Here.
All present and counted for. Council, remember the last day for Sylvia Stiles is the 30th. The 30th is a Friday at Wiku, and you'll get times and everything there. So, okay, now we have a special presentation surrounding the an issue that's dear to all of us, and this is regarding the Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. And our first speaker will be Edna Shin from the Seattle Children's Hospital. Welcome, welcome. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you for inviting me to come out here and speak to you all. While I might live in Seattle and work in Seattle, I wasn't always a city girl. I have to say I'm a former Sandwich Spartans, and I'm sorry to say that in front of the Ferndale Eagle crowd, but I did transfer to Kent Ridge High School, so this is familiar territory for me. So it's nice driving through downtown and kind of feels back home again. So I want to thank you, the mayor, and city council for this special proclamation and for the recognizing National Childhood Awareness Month. I want to let you know the statistics for Ferndale, in particular, in 2010. What I think would be interesting for folks here to know is that in 2010, the inpatient statistics were, there were 86 patients, 56 were males, 30 females, 22 visited a hematology and oncology unit, 13 were general surgery patients, and 10 were general medicine patients. For the outpatient statistics, I'd like you to know that there were 138 patients. In addition, there were 45 kids that visited our emergency department, and as far as age ranges, it was all across the board. And that was for the past year for Ferndale alone. So I want to let you know again what we're up to and let you know what we're trying to do and a little bit about our mission. We believe all children have unique needs and should grow up without illness or injury. With the support of the community, and through our spirit of inquiry, we will prevent, treat, and eliminate pediatric disease. Our vision is that we will be the best children's hospital. We will provide patients and their families excellent care with compassion and respect. We will provide superior, accessible, cost-effective service. We will attract and retain the best talent at all levels of our organization. We will be one of the top five pediatric research institutions. We will be the nation's premier pediatric educators, and we will achieve worldwide prominence by integrating patient care, research, education, advocacy. I think it's what's really exciting for children these days is that we opened a new center for childhood cancer research in July 2011. It's down at South Lake Union. It's in the biotech corridor. What's so amazing about this is that we are one of three pediatric hospitals in the nation with a facility capable of an industry manufacturing process to produce new therapies to treat childhood diseases on site. Our key research partners are Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, and UW Medical Center. I'd like to bring to your attention some of the community benefits we do. We have this uncompensated care program that is unparalleled to many institutions. We provide financial assistance to families who need it, whether they visit the hospital's main campus in Seattle, a regional clinic, or an outreach clinic. In 2010 alone, Children's provided $102 million in uncompensated care. This is a 6% increase from 2009 and a 144% increase since 2006. So that tells you what's going on in our economy today and the needs of healthcare, especially for kids. So what we would like to promise is that we will be an advocate for children and their families. We promise to provide the best possible care, regardless of your insurance coverage or financial circumstances, to every child and teenager in Washington, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho that needs us. Our financial assistance program helps families. This is what our founders promised, and we will continue to honor this no matter how difficult our economic climate. And I wanted to let you know that in our terms of our strategic plan, we're growing on our main campus. This is down in Sandpoint Way in Seattle. We are expanding. We're hoping to get phase one up and running. We're in the construction phase right now in 2 years. We're hoping to have more single-family patient rooms so families can live and stay with their kids when they're sick. Right now, it's really tough when kids have and families and patients have to share rooms. It's a lack of privacy. It's really upset your routine. And just want to let you know how much we just want to take care of our patients. And it's not just taking care of the child. It's taking care of the child's whole family network. And that's what we're here for. So, again, thank you for inviting us. And we hope we can continue to serve you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Next up, we have from the Puget Sound Blood Center, Tanya. Welcome, Tanya.
So, thank you all. As she just said, thank you all for having me. I just wanted to give everyone a little bit of information. I know that a month like this month, we're centering on childhood cancer. We at the Puget Sound Blood Center, in our bone marrow program, we offer services primarily focusing on those who donate to children like Simon and enable him to be able to sit here today. I just want to give everyone a little bit of information in the event that any of you may ever be interested. And I'm having the enormous, enormous privilege of being able to save the life of a child like Simon or any other adult. Also, we at the Blood Center are the local liaison for the National Marrow Donor Program. And so if anyone here is interested in becoming a bone marrow donor, you're always welcome to request the paperwork and the quick cheat swab from us at the Blood Center. It's always free of charge. There's never any cost to someone as long as you go through our organization to join. Joining is very, very simple. You have to be between the ages of 18 and 60. You have to be willing to donate to any patient in need, and you have to be in good general health. So as you can see here today, we have a little face like that looking out at you, and I do believe that Simon was the recipient of an unrelated donor. So literally what happens is a patient like Simon gets sick, and his doctor will then go to the national registry and start looking for a match for him. And that is when an opportunity for someone that has indicated that they would be a donor becomes available. And you can step up and say, you know what, I understand that there's a little boy out there that needs my help, and I'm willing to step up and help save his life. And so I just wanted to make everyone aware that it's very simple and very easy to do. And if you just want to contact our department at the Puget Sound Blood Center, we are more than happy always to set you up and get you on that registry. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I got to go a little bit off my agenda here because another special place in my heart. I know there's a group of gentlemen in the audience that do a lot of work, and they don't get recognized. So I'd love a member of the Bikers Fighting Cancer to come forward and then maybe introduce all your members. So one of you can do it.
Sorry. I myself am not very presentable. I'm working at the moment.
You're a biker. There's a certain image.
We have a few guys. Dan, who's local from Whatcom County here. Jim in the far back, local from Whatcom County, and then we actually had Putt-Putt and Rat City, who came up from Seattle today for this, and from Darrington back there we have Arnie. I guess this is real near and dear to us. You know, we work one-on-one with a lot of kids, and big thing for me when I look at this is that kids dealing with cancer, they're dealing with such an adult thing, you know, and it's just really hard to watch. And it's, you know, we've had a lot that we've helped and that we've visited and been pretty close to and watched them pass away. And, you know, it's a tough thing, and we do what we can, and we try real hard to help the families and stuff. And so, you know, financially, it's a tough thing in the economy currently, but yeah, we work hard to try and provide for those families and help those kids live a child's life while they're dealing with an adult situation.
Thank you. Thanks, Christian. I just wanted to say to all of you that anyone in the city that you know about handed out some brochures. Our primary purpose, I've got more if anybody needs it. Our primary focus is to help kids with cancer. We fill some of the voids that their insurance doesn't cover, and then we adopt kids if their parents are willing, and we give them guts. But our primary, we are 501c3. We are a nonprofit corporation. So we've got the rules of a motorcycle club and the rules of a corporation. And sometimes it's a thing you undertake. Politics are always mixed. But anyway, that's what we do with our kids. So if anybody has any kids, or you or your officers, you have a child here in Ferndale, and they need some assistance, we help with things like.
Thank you for attending. Thank you very much. Okay, we have a first official City of Ferndale Mayor Proclamation. Whereas thousands of children nationwide, including Ferndale and Whatcom County, fight pediatric cancer every year, and whereas research advances are making childhood cancer more treatable than ever, and whereas cancer remains the leading cause of death by disease for children under the age of 15, and whereas September is recognized across America as National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, I now therefore, Gary Jensen, Mayor, City of Ferndale, do hereby proclaim September 2011 as Childhood Cancer Awareness Month in the City of Ferndale, and I urge all citizens to join me in reaffirming our commitment to fighting childhood cancer. Our children who battle pediatric cancer should be considered little heroes for the fight. We are fortunate in Washington State that we enjoy a wealth of support in families, organization, and treatment facilities in the battle against childhood cancer. I also want to bring up a young gentleman here that deserves a Brave Award, and I also have an award for another part of the family. So I'd like to bring up Simon DiArenzio and Taylor.
Okay, are you ready?
Okay, we're back in session. I'm going to jump up and I'm going to go to item D because we have some time constraints. And this one, boy, this one's special to me because a lot of times in my speeches to young people in the city of Ferndale, and I've done this at the American Legion a couple times, and I always ask young people, I want you to live here, grow up here, and you get a great ability to grow up and have a nice atmosphere in Ferndale. But I want you to leave here, go get educated, go out in the world, and then I want you to come back, and I want you to come back and give something to Ferndale. I'm always recruiting the next mayor candidate to come out here. But this one, tonight, we're going to introduce you a police officer that's kind of a heck of a story because he grew up in Ferndale. He went to Ferndale High School, served his country in the military, and got some experience in law enforcement elsewhere, and he came back. And Councilperson Hansen and I have a special thing is that we know somewhere up there, and there's an ex-bar owner and his dad, and he's smiling tonight. So we'd like him to come forward and introduce himself. Chief, you're in charge now since I'm not handling this well.
It's always a pleasure, of course, to come before the council. I'm certainly humbled to have to follow the remarks of the mayor in introducing this young officer. There are two emotions that an officer is trained to deal with. The first is disappointment. Mr. Pike realized that the people that were here at the beginning of the session were not here for his investiture. So now he is dealing with the first element of his career. The second, of course, is terror. A police officer's job is 99% boredom and 1% terror, and we are giving him the opportunity today in addressing the council to be part of that 1%, and I know he will do well. In fact, what the mayor has said, prologue, he was born, this young officer, in Bellingham, raised in Ferndale, and is a graduate of Ferndale High School. We keep our unbroken record of hiring only the finest in character, in values, in background, career potential, and good looks, if not height. This gentleman served in the United States Army for 4 years, both in Korea and in Iraq. He was a cavalry scout. He is married, been married for 9 years. I have met his wife and children. Wonderful, wonderful family. His wife is Holly Walton of Ron and Shauna Walton. You probably know them very well. And his children, Jackson, Logan, and Hadley. I can't tell you how delighted we are to have this young man for a couple of reasons. Number one, he lives in our town, and he has the values of Ferndale. And two, he's already attended the Basic Law Enforcement Academy, and so he's already a licensed peace officer. So he comes fully equipped, battery included, and he's ready to go. And he only has a 12 to 14 week probationary field training to do, and then he is ready to go. I'm just going to say one thing while I still have him up here, because this is a perfect opportunity. One of his mentors is standing in the back of the room, and that's Jared Hecton. He's been here as long as I have, 6 years. He's a sergeant. He is without a doubt one of the finest gentlemen I have ever met in my 71 years on this earth. He is a person of great character. He has just received his master's in theology, and we will doubtlessly be losing him because he is going to pursue his heart's ambition of following the ministry and probably going to Thailand. So he is going to be a terrible loss, only offset by having a person of your character in your background, and I welcome you here to the city of Ferndale. Thank you very much.
Hopefully I'll see you all in the future and be able to interact with you guys. Have a good day. So in the Pike tradition, Pike family tradition, I mean, how many more children are we going to see, you know, here?
Maybe one more. I say two.
That's just me.
I think all will have
something to say. Go out and solve a crime.
Well, we don't mean to know.
That's great.
A man of few words.
Okay. Now we'll go to the public comment period. This is anything that's not on tonight's agenda. We've run through most of the agenda. So anyone else that would love to come forward to speak on it? I see all kinds of hands up. Everybody in the crowd wants to speak. You're first. Welcome.
Reverend Arlene Ferguson, 5606 First Avenue. I can't quite wrap my mind around this, and I would like some feedback from any of you. Now, the people that moved in next door have been extremely noisy for 2 years, but this summer has been, like, over the top. So after 11 o'clock, I go, that's just really enough. So I started calling the police a couple of months ago. And when they first moved in, the three boys were kicking their ball constantly against the fence. And I'd say, this looks like it's really firm, but it's not. These slats are really pretty fragile. You're going to break the fence. The father has heard it, went on deaf ears, as you've got the school across the street. You've got the big lot, the alley. Please don't keep kicking my fence. So I got a new dog about a month ago and came home and he wasn't in the yard. So I walk around looking, where could he possibly have gotten out? Well, three of the boards on their side were kicked into my side. And so I called the police, and Officer Grant came out. And he had talked to the boys first, and so he came over, and I took him to show him the boards, and he said, I talked to the boys. They said, they didn't do this. This has been this way for a long time. I don't know what a long time is to 8 to 12-year-olds, but I said, oh, so you're going to take their word over an ex-teacher and a counselor. Yes, I am. Children don't lie. They are incapable of lying. Those are his quotes. I said, thank you for coming. I walked into the gate, and that was that. What do you do when an officer tells you children aren't capable of lying? And I've been dealing with this for almost 2 years. So I said, well, I'm not getting any help from the police. I'm going to the landlord because the new law is the landlord is responsible for the tenant's actions. And they said that they would repair. I'm still waiting. This is at least 3 weeks, maybe going on 4 weeks, waiting for them to repair my fence. But it's pretty discouraging to have an officer come out and tell me that. So if anybody has any feedback, I would definitely appreciate where to go from here.
What is your address
on
first?
5606. Where'd
the dog go?
Ran out but didn't run away.
Through that hole in the fence?
Yeah. And I took pictures. I'm going to go get them developed where their chair is pushing through the boards from their side. And these people just don't get it. I'm talking at like 11, 12, 1 o'clock. For the noise. Their kids are out there playing at these hours, and it's gotten pretty bad. So actually, it's been extremely quiet since I went to the landlord. But really, I'm very concerned about the officer telling me that.
Administration will take this issue and move it forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I have two people in the same slot, so you're going to speak together. You guys are kind of a duo.
Yeah, in tandem.
You're tandem?
Mm-hmm.
I can hardly wait.
Stereo.
I'm excited. Welcome.
Uh-oh.
Do you like to do a dance, too? Or?
Not.
Okay, good. This is good.
We're happy.
Yeah.
You'll get this, the Doyen City. She's one of our
students. I'm Lucy Morris. I live at 2501 Mountain View Road.
I'm Sarah Macklis. I live at 2493 Mountain View Road.
And you might be, I don't know if you can guess why we're here. We're usually here either complaining or begging or demanding or something. And we're not here for that tonight. We just want to thank you. We want to thank you for taking the South Church Road off of the Transportation Improvement Plan. And the reason we're thanking you is that we're quite relieved. We feel like we can live our lives. Some of you will remember back in the last administration, there was a real move, and I could understand it, to put in South Church Road. When you look at either from the south or the north, you say, no-brainer, you've got to go through. But other things have to happen first, and I think, and I don't know what your reasons were, but we're really happy. So thank you. I don't know if you listened to us or if it was other considerations. It doesn't matter. We're very pleased. So thanks a lot.
Comments for the dynamic duo from the council?
Oh, no. She's out. She's next.
Oh, she has more.
I was going to say a little one-sided so far. Let's see.
Uh-oh.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you, too. We know a lot of thought's gone into this, and you've put up with us for 6 years, and we've shown up at the wrong meetings and the right meetings, and you've been patient and kind every time, and we just wanted to thank you all for being so thoughtful and keeping the people in your community in mind, not just a project. And we're really grateful. You've made a huge difference in our lives, in our neighborhood, in our families, and we appreciate you listening. Thank you. That's why we're here tonight.
I just want to say something. All of you know that we live outside city limits.
We're county people.
We're county, right. We live out there. And for you to listen to county residents who are involved with the city of Ferndale, but you're listening to county residents, and I really appreciate that. I mean, just that dynamic, too.
Yeah.
Councilperson Zimmerman.
That's great. Another question, Lucy. Was there a resignation of the lady who replaced you, and who might replace her? Or?
You want me to go into that at this point?
I just heard about it here recently.
Yeah.
We miss you, and she was your.
We're in an interim phase at this point, is what I would say. And yes, Jenna Hartman did resign.
Yeah.
We're not sure exactly. We have volunteers in there at the moment. There are two volunteers, and the resource center is open 20 hours a week. There's still a community jobs person at the desk. And we're looking for more volunteers to help staff the resource center. And we're not sure if we're getting another VISTA yet. We hope we will. But even so, that's going to be up in April. And so, but the board of the service cooperative is also reforming and developing a sense of responsibility for the resource center that is very different from the previous. And I think that it's really time for the community to back it and figure out, okay, how can we keep the resource center open? How can we support it? How can we fund a part-time director?
It's budget time.
It is. We've been working on that for the past couple of years, at least past 3 years or so. But we're not all the way there, and it's tough times to be looking for that kind of money. But anyway, just so you all know, and I guess we haven't formed a formal announcement yet, and so I think we're going to be okay. A couple volunteers stepped right forward, and I think it's going to keep going. So we will keep you posted. I wanted to be able to make an announcement to you when we knew more about where we were going to head. But
I just had it there in the
right
headlines.
Because it came in your email.
You've
right.
Done a great job, and it's just there's a greater need than ever right now.
So I think so. Like I think so. Let me just tell you, the first week that the other bank was open, 23 families came. Today, I think it was 78 people. I don't know how many families, but 78 people were served at the other bank. So there's a definite need, and it was not open during the summer. So. I'm sure there are ways that we can work on it. But thanks for asking. I appreciate it. Okay. Thanks, you guys.
Oh, thanks, everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, there's one more.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
I just want to quickly thank you for coming in. This is probably the second time maybe somebody's ever come and thanked the council for doing something since I've been here. It's my short time. So thank you. And Sue, I got a shirt idea for you. You just inspired. Get with me after.
Well, you know, we wanted to come in June, and it's been summer. What can we say?
Yeah.
Here we go.
But, yeah,
thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Whatever Manuel's wife's doing, the dance lessons are working.
Thank you.
Second Avenue Shuffle.
You can't have this kind of fun. Okay, anyone else for a public? guy beat you. So, okay. You're giving away the mantle. Welcome, sir.
Manuel Reta, 2064 Main Street, Colima Design, President of the Northwest Washington Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I would like to see if the city can help us out on the reader board. September 17th, we have Fiestas Patrias. Okay, we're going to be having lowriders, a parade, and basically it should be a good time, weather permitting. Everybody should get involved. And so where there's a way you can just let people know because it's good for the community. 5 years ago, I came before the council. And at first, I recall somebody saying to open a can of worms, I believe. And that person, whatever it may be, I believe the events have been very positive. We can agree to that because I've been trying to stay on top of things. I'm a strong believer that whatever I say, I have to follow up with it completely, entirely. The other thing, too, is, you know, it's basically it's an event for everybody. You know, it's just a good family event. So, yes, my wife is a certified Zumba instructor, and that's where they came from. Thank you.
And it gets better every year, man.
Yes?
Quick question. Do we have or can we look into a policy for community groups that want to advertise on our reader board or and or our big reader board and
yeah, we
come
we
up with something
we
like that?
We basically hardly say no to anybody.
Okay.
Anybody that contacts the city clerk, he makes it happen. And if he can, he gets it on the Lummi Nation one and then ours.
And you probably need some artwork or...
I appreciate
probably
it.
Need some artwork. If you had some artwork or some basic artwork, that'd probably get, I don't know what kind of format it's in, but something to think about.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Guy? Welcome, welcome.
Pass that out. I know. Nice introduction for the first thing I want to talk about.
Don't we have a dress code for you know speakers here?
Hey, I'm dressed just as good as some of you, so I don't want to hear it.
Gorgeous T-shirt. What are you talking about?
Exactly. Exactly. So that's really why I wanted to come up today, was to simply say thank you to all of you, because I know most of you, council, staff included, were helping in some way for the street festival. I think it was a successful event. We did hear that there were some noise complaints towards the top of church and Thornton regarding the music a little late on Saturday, and we will address that. And we actually have a plan in place for that for next year. But we thank the community for...
Turn them up.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
They'll be appreciated.
So, but I really wanted to thank staff, police department included, for all the hard work regarding some of the late notifications that we got regarding some potential items of interest. But I think the festival went off a fantastic eighth year. We grew. The city looked like it handled it very well, so we're looking at that will probably be the same setup for next year. And just again, thank all of you for your support. Whether it be money, whether it be time, whether it be having a booth, as some of you did. I will let Mel and Paul address the hot dog sales when they choose to. I don't think that the tallies are ready yet. So we'll have that at another time. But just thank you. But the second thing I wanted to come out, it should be passed around because I have the stack here. This is something brand new that we're starting. Very similar to our holiday light contest that we do with residents. In December, this is something that just decided, hey, we have no time. Let's do something new. So it's a brand new program. It's a residential landscaping contest. As you can tell, that there are five categories that we're doing. We're partnering with ACE and the Ferndale Record. And for those of you that live in the Ferndale area and would like to participate, that's awesome. If you know of other people, that's really great. Basically, I'm coming up here to see if we can get some extra help in getting some publicity, getting some legs under this event, and make it an annual thing. So, any questions?
Questions for Guy? Councilperson Goodrich?
I'd just like to thank you for again for the work for the festival. I really like the street festival. To me, this year was really a lot better than last year without having the boost down the middle of the street.
I take full credit for that. I rarely have a really good idea, and that was mine.
Yeah, to me that worked out really, really well and made it a lot more enjoyable to walk around. And
I would completely agree. The one downfall to not having the center is it was really open, so the numbers looked down. Were the numbers down? There's some vendors that say yes, and there's some vendors that say no. And it's important that it stays a free event, so that you can realistically go down with an entire family and enjoy the entire day and only spend money on food at the absolute least. And so that's vital for us. And up until we start charging, we will have no idea as to how many people attend, and so I don't see us doing that.
I also was surprised at the number of people that were out of state that I talked mm-hmm. to that either were passing by and somehow heard about it or were in the Bellingham, Ferndale area mm-hmm. and heard about it, so they thought they'd come over and check it out.
Yeah, part of putting on an event like that is really targeting your community partners outside of Ferndale, like the Tourism Bureau and the advertising opportunities. Of the region, so, and that's how we get that. We a lot of little tiny advertising that's $50 here, $100 there, that puts us out into the greater market. Utilizing Facebook, we knew that would be such a grand idea. So it's just the little things, the nickel and dimes of a $30,000 event that you know bring in the people. So
I can tell you guys that it is working.
That's because that artist that we have does a phenomenal job.
I have to talk to her about that. But really, we had some friends of ours who lived down in Kirkland, and not only did they come up with their young son, they brought the majority of their neighborhood with them. There was about 40 of them, and they all said, let's go to Ferndale for the street festival. And they drove up and had a ball and went home happy. So we're getting the word out there, and it's getting better every year. And
Keep going.
I think that shirt's going to be hard to top, though.
I know. But August 24th, 25th of 2012, Market. So, and if anybody in the audience would like one of these, so they are available online. I did get yours today. Yep. So, good. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else for the public comment period? Anyone else?
I would have had that one.
It's not like everyone else in the audience talks. Okay, moving on, back to the agenda, I would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Okay, next up, item E, the public hearing on the Crown Court latecomers agreement has been canceled on advice from legal counsel, so that's all we're going to talk about that for now. Next one is the resolution for the sidewalk construction contract. And I'll go to our public works director.
Tomorrow we open bids on our two small sidewalk projects, and that was on 2nd Avenue from the Boys and Girls Club to the ConocoPhillips. And the other one is along the Loy from just the end of the, just north of the roundabout up to Oxford. And that on the Loy, the sidewalk will just be on the one side. So we're on the west side up to Sunrise, and then we switch to the other side. And so I'm requesting City Council approval to go ahead and award the bid after we review and tabulate the bids on the 7th. So we can move forward and send out contract documents to get the contractor out there as soon as possible.
I'm going to move to give the Public Works Director authorization to go as high as $260,000 on the approval of the council so that we can, well, I'll just leave it at the motion. I'll discuss it if there's a second.
Do I have a second to further
I'll
discuss?
Second it.
Okay, so second by Councilman Goodrich. I have in line Councilperson Mutzler, Zimmerman, then Goodrich.
Point of order, the maker of the motion always gets the first opportunity to speak.
Okay.
Please. I'm just going to say that we have a weather window, and we'd like to, and it's either that or a special council meeting to try and get this approved. If we approve it in advance with some limitations, that means the contractor, whoever that ends up being, you can get them started as quickly as possible so that we don't have an issue with not having them for the weather. It's all there.
Councilperson Mutzler?
I was just going to make the motion.
Councilperson Zimmerman?
Well, tagging on to Mel's weather window concept. Now, Jas, did you unbundle this? Did you look at two separate projects? Because if we've got a definition of time that we have to work with, then, you know, one company getting both sidewalk projects, I would think we'd get it done faster if you took the first bid, second bid, or bid them separately, so you have to put two companies to work as opposed to one that's completing one and then going to do the other one.
Well, based on the Washington State Department of Transportation, their recommendation, they recommended that the city that we combine the two bids and bid it that way. They felt that was more would be more cost effective to just have the one bid it as one project and have one contractor rather than have two contractors mobilized to the site. So based on their recommendation, then we move forward and receive approval to bid it as one project.
And given the weather, we're probably going to put two.
Right, and then for the number of working, these are working days, 35 working days for the project. And some of that is just the concrete is just curing.
Councilperson Goodrich? I have a question to Councilmember Hansen on his motion. Does that 260 include the contingency or 260 plus the 10% contingency?
Well, the 260 is essentially it's taking the figure 210 to 250,000, which is the engineering estimate, and adding 10,000. I don't know. Did the 210 to 250 include a contingency?
No, on the engineer's estimate.
So
we
then
just
my
get
motion
the range.
would not have included a contingency.
Yeah.
It was only to give the public works director the opportunity to go ahead and approve a contract that was up to 10,000 over. Our experience in the last few months, year or so, is that they'll probably be under, but we don't know that. If it comes in at 261,000 and that's the actual contractor's bid, then Janice is going to have to work. Is going to have to bring that back to council for approval or disapproval or start.
Well, I was just wondering if we needed to, in the motion of the 260, add the 10% contingency as well onto that, or how that needs to be stated.
Are you recommending a 10% contingency?
Well, I just saw it here in their resolution. It states wherever G is here.
Yeah. Also authorizes a 10% contingency over the low bid amount.
Mm-hmm. So you say the 260 plus the 10%. I'm in agreement if that's what you
want. I think based on what's in the resolution, I missed that when I read the resolution, but based on what's in the resolution, I would agree that it should be. I was thinking raw bid of mm-hmm. $260,000. That's including sales tax that comes in from the contractor. That if we want to put a contingency on top of that, that should be in addition to that bid. So I would accept that if the entire council is willing to accept that and the seconds. Or I'll
do we need
put
to do
the
two separate things
no,
now?
We can do it as long as it's unanimous.
You need the unanimous consent or a formal motion.
So I see Councilperson Mutchler.
I'd rather vote on a contingency after we have a bid like we've done in the past. We usually get a bid on a project, and then we consider a contingency after that. This is, we still have to approve the bid, don't we? After we
well,
bring
we're doing
no,
it now.
That's what you're doing.
Yeah,
right
that's
now.
What I'm asking for now.
I apologize.
And typically we bring to council the low bid and the plus the 10% contingency. It's at the same time. And we make a recommendation to award with the contingency.
What you're doing now is you are doing this a little different than you usually do because mm-hmm. we're trying to hit that weather window. Councilperson Zimmerman?
Well, let me just clarify where this money is coming. This is COG, Council of Government money. Is that correct? County money?
No, it's federal.
It's all federal
Highway
money.
Administration money that we applied for it through the through COG.
Through COG.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we need
the federal money.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, my recommendation was just, hey, break it up in 2 months. There's plenty of hungry businesses out there. If break up the two of them. It just get done that much faster.
So and it's already out the bid, though.
Right?
So, Councilor Ford asking, restate if you get an unanimous.
Well, at this point in time, it looks like we would not get a unanimous. So I will move. I would move to amend the motion by adding the 10% contingency to the authorization for the Public Works Director.
Okay. So then, moved and second on the amendment first. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
I was just going to ask to discuss it, but I don't know if it's on the amendment. I think my discussion's on the main motion, so I don't have anything to say on this.
Okay, so on the amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Okay, motion carries 5-1. On the main motion, Councilperson Malpezzi.
So I'm just trying to figure out, because the ordinance doesn't have a dollar amount. It just says the budget amount, but I believe your motion restricts it to a dollar amount?
Well, because of your agenda bill. The engineer's estimate has been 210 to 250.
Yeah, no, I see that. I just want to be confident that we're limiting it.
It restricts it to a dollar amount of no more than 200. At first, we discussed having it, as long as it's within the engineer's estimate, it's okay to sign the contract. And then we said, let's give a little bit of wiggle room. So I add 10,000 to the engineer's estimate. That's why the specific dollar.
Okay.
So if it's 260,000 and 1 cent, essentially, Dennis has got to bring that back to the next council meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. So we'll essentially be amending this ordinance here, or resolution. I'm sorry, resolution to reflect that. Okay.
Councilor Zimmerman,
and how much is the actual money that we got from?
We got a little over 200,000, and so then the rest is made up with city money.
City money.
Mm-hmm. From general, water, and storm.
So we've got that in there, Mark, somewhere?
Yeah, like Janet said, the revenues are in the budget currently at 203. Okay. The cost is total of 240.
This is 2010 money that we're spending.
So it's 2011. Mm-hmm. So 37,000 comes from solid waste tax. That makes up the city match. Of 240. If it goes higher under your ceiling, then we'll just grab a little more money from solid waste.
Councilor Hanson?
Well, I'd like to respond to Councilmember Zimmerman's request at this late point of splitting this. If we were to split this now, we would cancel all bids. We can't split it without, number one, canceling all bids, re-advertising them, yeah. Starting over, which would put us at least October, middle of October to start.
Yeah.
So now is not the time. I think when we talk about this
committee
coming up, maybe that should have been a discussion, but now it's a moot question.
And just comment, if I could, Mayor. The funder, given us a $203,000, has said that it is in one contract. So we kind of got to do it. They got the money. You kind of got to follow what they. They got the money. They kind of got the power. This small, 31 days, like Janice said, 35 days. Some of that will be cement drying, so there won't be any work going on. So short term projects. Shouldn't be a whole lot of contingency needed, but I hear what you're saying.
Okay. Any further discussion on the main motion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, motion carries 6-0. Okay, next up is item G. This is regarding the Planning Commission opening. Councilor, you may recall in our last Planning Commission opening, we had one applicant only. Tough choice for you. We chose that applicant. This time around, through some effort from council members and advertising, we had three outstanding applicants. And after much debate, I'm submitting one name for you. Tim Cornwell, and I entertain a motion to approve that. Councilperson Mutchler?
I move that Mr. Cornwell is approved as the next Planning Commission member for the City of Ferndale.
Second.
And Council Ford, if you have any further discussion, Mr. Cornwell is here in the audience if you'd like to ask any questions. Councilperson Malpezzi?
I was going to second. I also had a question. How many openings are there, and is this filling?
Just one.
All right, and this is?
That was Phil Petrosic. Okay. Resigned for reading. He needs to spend more time taking care of his aging father-in-law.
Thank you.
Who's getting a little bit better, by the way?
What's that?
Who's getting a little bit better, by the way?
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can have questions, Mr. Cornwell, or we could go to a vote.
Was this a term? I don't remember seeing.
Is this filling out a term?
Yes.
Or?
January 1st, 2015.
Okay. It says right there on the...
Yeah.
Okay, any further discussion or desire to hear from Mr. Cornwell?
Oh, yeah.
I think we should.
Councilor Zimmerman, would you like to come forward and introduce yourself?
Sure.
At least we'll know who you are.
Not scared.
Well, hello, Council. I'm Tim Cornwell, and I'm very excited about this opportunity. I have no idea what to expect, but I'm game for it. Looking forward to serving this community and learning as much as I can.
Be prepared for a lot of reading as an ex-Planning Commission member.
Okay. Well, better block out some time then.
Yeah. You like it.
You already kills a lot of trees.
Okay.
Okay. And any other questions or comments from Mr. Cornwell? Okay. Well, you stand there and you can just bask in the vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion carries 6-0. Welcome. You're in.
Thank you. Did you hear that faint train whistle? You just running down the track. That's what that is.
Okay. So now, finally getting some things on the agenda. Multifamily density. Welcome, right. Mr. Burnett.
Council, new Planning Commission member. This is partially to help the Planning Commission. Last year, the City Council had the opportunity to approve or deny a comp plan change that would create a maximum density in our multifamily zones. Council determined that it was not appropriate at that time because Council wanted to look at the specific zones to look at possible increases or, for that matter, decreases to multifamily density. Right now, our high-density residential zones, RM 1.5 and RO, have a max density of 27 units per acre. We're only achieving about 16 units per acre. So based on Council's direction, the Planning Commission started to look at possible ways of getting more density into those zones, whether it be by adopting a maximum density of, say, 40 units per acre or 60 units per acre, by looking at what the market can sustain, and so on and so forth. So we came to the council committee, and coming out of the council committee, they basically indicated as a direction for Planning Commission and staff that rather than focusing on maximum densities, why not focus more on minimum densities, set the floor for development, and then allow the market to bear what the market will bear. And so on page 70 of your packet, I have a paragraph that I'll read to you, and then if you agree with it, you can tell me. If you don't, then you can tell me why not. This would be direction to staff and Planning Commission. The Council wishes to remove maximum densities within certain areas currently zoned RM 1.5 and RO that are suitable for additional dense multifamily development. Existing neighborhoods that are intact and or are generally fully developed to historic densities may be preserved under existing regulations. In order to prevent development below what has been anticipated, the city should identify minimum densities. The Planning Commission should also reevaluate parking requirements for multifamily development in order to ensure that parking requirements reflect actual demand.
So, Council, change of direction. I mean, if you wanted to read that again, but it's a pretty big statement. So first stand up was Councilperson Mutchler, then Goodrich, and then Hansen.
Well, I wanted to have the discussion, so I'd like to make a motion that Council ask the Planning Commission to move in the direction that Yuri has provided here in this paragraph that he just read.
So do I have a second to move discussion farther?
I'll second that.
Okay, so move and second, open discussion. Councilperson Mutchler will be first.
Yeah, and I just want to add a little bit to the narrative there. I think you mentioned, if not, I'll just say it again, that we moved as a council and following Planning Commission to go from 35 feet to 70 feet on the height of these buildings. But there was no change in the density. You already mentioned that we're not achieving the 27 units density now, which some have considered as an argument to not change anything. I would suggest that we're stuck at 16 because of the previous height limits. We're looking at four fourplexes on an acre, which we see a lot of that in Ferndale. It's totally understandable. What I'm troubled with a bit is that we are stating in so many places our comp plan and our actions that we want higher density in places, but we're telling developers you're limited to 27 units, which is not very much on an acre of land when you can put about 150 parking spots conceivably on an acre of land. Now, this is where I think maybe being liaison to the commission is helpful to this body. And listening to their discussion, I think the concern of the Planning Commission is that Ferndale has a certain flavor and feel to it, and the multifamily areas tend to be, and I'm using, I think, their words, more low-profile, more medium-density feel to it. And I think there's a consensus on the Planning Commission that they want to preserve that in at least some parts of Ferndale. So what Yori's proposed here is that they look at those large areas, the RM 1.5, and the residential office areas, and consider some of those areas that may be appropriate for some much higher density areas, and that we remove the high density limit on that, and let the sort of market take over on something like that. That's what I think is the intent of that. Yes, they may not want, and we may not want those areas to be completely covered with 70-foot buildings, but perhaps there are some appropriate areas for that.
Well, and it's important for council to provide some direction, because when we come back in 6 months or a year or however long, this is the direction that staff and Planning Commission will go on, or whatever you ultimately vote for. So,
but recognize we did provide direction about a year ago. I want to remind council that we had opportunity to vote on 40 units. Was it 40, Yuri?
Yes, sir.
We voted no on the 40, the staff recommendation, because we thought it wasn't too high. We thought it wasn't high enough. And so we did send this back to the Planning Commission once. Basically, if I recall, it said, why didn't you consider even possibly no limit? And they did come back to us for our request and said, we don't really want to do that. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I think the council ended up providing direction on the height limits as far as the direction given on the comprehensive plan amendment. I think that the understanding of council was fairly clear that they did not want to. They were not saying no because they wanted to do less. But I think this gives us clearer direction as far as what the parameters and what the goal is.
In that, what we're saying now is, okay, Planning Commission, find some areas where we would feel comfortable as a city, not blanket the whole thing. But there are some, and I'm comfortable with that too, by the way. I think that is a little more narrower perspective.
Absolutely.
Councilor Goodrich, Hansen, then Zimmerman.
As a person that's involved with seniors and on a daily basis, one of the things that came up was parking associated with seniors. I think this is maybe something we need to look at as the Planning Commission, is what is the use of the building? Is it going to be like where I used to live, where they did retail down below and then four stories of senior housing? To me, your parking requirements are going to be different for four stories of senior housing versus four stories of condominiums or something. So I think the use of the building may have to have something to do with the parking associated with the building. In answer to the question that came up at a committee, I did check it at work where I have. We have 166 units. We have 83 parking places. And we don't have enough parking places when you take staff into consideration, too. So that may be something, too, that if you're looking at it from a senior housing point of view, I don't know how our code deals with that, but you also have the residents, and then you have caregivers that come in. You know, whether they be employed by the company or visiting angels. And so you need to look at the appropriate parking thing. Our 0.5 to 1 isn't cutting it at Spring Creek. But, it may work in a senior, building type of thing. I don't know. But I just thought I'd share that with you what I've looked at this past week since committee. That may be something to look at is the use. But I like this idea of going to a minimum standard and then let the market dictate via what they can get as far as number of car parking spots and things like that. I just don't want us to build something that we end up eating up street parking because we didn't make enough requirements. And then you end up with the streets being clogged because there's not enough visitor parking or other issues.
Houseperson Hansen, and then Zimmerman, Ingram, and then back to Mutchler.
I would caution the Planning Commission to not get too carried away with minimums. I'm more of a property rights kind of person, that if I own a piece of property and I want to put a really nice pair of fourplexes on an acre, and you've told me that I have to have at least 12 units, I'm going to be unhappy, because I might want to put in a little park and make some really high-end units out of that. I guess my caution is study that very carefully. Don't make it so restrictive that someone can't come along and have a really good idea. I don't have a number in mind. It's just a caution to the Planning Commission. They're too restrictive on minimum. Could be just as. Yeah, but his method, did he have 14 on 2.5 acres? Yeah.
That was the zero lot lines on the lake.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't think that we should allow necessarily on our 1.5 a triplex on an entire acre. That's, you know, you're not going to achieve your density as per the GMA. But by the same token, I don't think you better go to 16 as a minimum for an acre and then find out that somebody's got a really nice project and wants to put 8 in.
Mm-hmm. Councilor Zimmerman?
I would, I'm also very cautious about this, having been on the Planning Commission and also thought about and visited communities. Look at Linden, how they handled their apartments. And then you look at Bellingham, how they handled their apartments. Because, you know, right now you're with our height ordinances and what we're trying to achieve in our densities. You go over to Linden and just see how they handle it. It's really interesting. It's almost like you can't see them. And then you look at the social problems. If you look at the Texas and the States area over by the Boys and Girls Club in Bellingham, and what is so dense with apartments that there's a lot of police calls and public services that are needed in that area. So I really think, you know, take a good look at it, because once you start letting this genie out of the box and say, oh, here's a vacant lot, let's pop a fourplex here, you're really, it's like blockbusting. You're taking really changing that neighborhood, and yeah, if you go up, or it almost seems like they should have, like, if you're putting, like, you know, a 10-plex or whatever going vertical, there should almost be like a PUD. You know, you're talking like a little skyscraper that's going to have social impacts and parking and everything else. It's and right besides a little tiny little cracker box house. So there's some, you've got your work cut out for you if you want to, you know, make Ferndale seem to have that good feel. So.
Well, and incidentally, with that, we're not going to bring this back by the end of the year. This is a 2012 project. We've got a lot. Yeah.
Councilperson Mutchler?
First of all, I totally agree with Councilmember Hansen. We don't really have a land inventory problem right now. And putting a minimum on might in the future be a good idea to do that. My primary motivation is to remove the maximum density or make it really high. I see that favorable towards developers who might be tempted to put an attractive 70-foot building. 70 feet sounds high, but it's really not a skyscraper. It's something we can manage. On parking, currently we require 2 spots per unit, and those are, I think, 8 feet by 19-foot spots. I was just wondering, I'm looking here at 1836090, and it has the single-family and duplex at 2 parking spaces per dwelling, but the multifamily is 1.5. Is this old, not been updated, or?
That has not been updated. One of the things.
But it is 2.
It is 2.
It should be 2.
Oh, yeah. 1.5.
Okay. It is. That is accurate.
Because 2, I mean, 2 is pretty good. And my feeling is parking should drive the thing. You know, and when I drive up to Semiyama, unfortunately, they're empty buildings because they're in. But all this parking's underneath. And these beautiful condos are arising from the ground. All the parking's hidden. So theoretically, you could have 100% parking somewhere on that thing and build your building. So I'm not sure as a city official why I would care how many units you can get on that thing, as long as you meet the setbacks, you meet the SEPA, you meet the parking, and you could get up quite a bit. So I don't know if we need a number. I don't know if you need a number, 70, 60, or if you don't have to have a number. That's something I'm curious about.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things that Planning Commission is going to look at. But certainly there are, Councilmember Zimmerman pointed out that sometimes there are concerns about non-environmental issues, traffic, all that, crime, things like that,
right,
which are in the eye of the beholder. To a certain extent, where you can have a very large apartment complex that is absolutely quiet, and you can have a very small apartment complex or a residence that is extremely loud. So the impacts do vary, but that's something that I think the Planning Commission, given council direction, can kind of sink their teeth into and know here's where we're going and how we get there. There can be various different ways.
Councilperson Ingram, and then to Mel Hezzy.
Yeah, I didn't notice it in the minutes of the committee meetings, but I just wanted to remind Yori that it was brought forward at the committee meeting that the coming wave in multifamily right now is smaller and smaller and smaller apartments.
The mini apartments.
They're the really tiny ones. And we need to remember to look at adjusting parking for that type of multifamily also, simply because if you've got a 600 or a 250 square foot apartment, odds are you may not even have a car. So you may be taking public transportation a lot. So just another thing to let them look at.
Basing parking on bedrooms, for instance, with something.
Councilperson Malkezi.
So if I'm following the discussion here, I'm sensing we may not want to regulate minimum densities. So I'm wondering if that is the case, then we probably want to remove this one sentence in your direction about identifying minimum densities.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, I have no problem with looking at it.
Just
be careful. Really careful that we set that at the right level.
And remember, this is a way to avoid things in the past where you're giving the Planning Commission kind of your general direction so they kind of know where to steer themselves.
Okay.
They don't do work for 2 years ago after we say no.
Correct. Councilperson Goodrich?
I think we need to leave the minimum density there, and I'd almost be more apt to stick with the 16 because it's an area of the city where we want higher density to begin with. And to say, well, gee, yeah, we'll do 12 or something like that, I don't know if that achieving the goal. Right now, like you already said, we're getting 16 units per acre. That's where that 16 came from.
That's maximum, though, not minimum.
That's what we're achieving.
That's what we're achieving.
Yeah, and that's saying that's what we're achieving, so that should be the minimum. You know, that's where that minimum number came from for Councilmember Malpezzi. But I don't know if we want to really go lower than that because of the idea of increasing the densities. That's the whole idea behind this.
Councilperson Hanson?
My whole point about bringing up the minimum was not to dictate to the Planning Commission what that minimum should be, just to be careful when you look at it, that you keep in mind that there are certain property rights out there that I, as an owner of a piece of property, should have. Granted, I can't go out in an RM 1.5 zone and build myself a house that's some sort of mansion right in the middle. You know, there is zoning requirements. However, I don't want anybody to tell me in the future that I can't build my house on a 2-acre lot, because I did. And it's up to me to split that lot and create density eventually. I don't want someone to tell me that, oh, you own an acre, so we're going to require you to put 16 units minimum on that. Mm-hmm. I think that's too much. I think that there's a figure. There is a figure. I don't think 16 is it. And when you say 16 is, it's been that we have achieved 16 per acre maximum. We have not achieved 27 per acre maximum. There's lots of situations where a smaller unit has been built on more acres than they could have built on. Right now, you've got to have 4,500 square feet for the first unit and 1,500 square feet for each unit thereafter. Correct? That's RM 1.5.
Correct. That, yeah. Okay. And which equals 27.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, you're voting on just a direction for for the Planning Commission that intends to spend a considerably long amount of time discussing this, so part of your discussion will be integrated into that in the future.
Right.
So
restate the motion?
You're not deciding the issue tonight. Councilperson John.
Yeah, I just, again, want to agree with Mel on the mental. And Mel's a great example. I mean, someday if he chooses to develop his 2 acres or whatever he has up there, he can do it. And I can certainly see somebody in one of these zones, I'd like to do this right now. They're not going to cover the entire 2 acres of a house. They're going to put something, and they're going to perhaps do the rest of it. I hate to tell a guy you can't do that when, again, there's not a lack of inventory for land. So I would resist the minimum at this point as well. But certainly let's get rid of the maximum and see what happens.
Councilperson Zimmerman?
Well, at some point in time, could he subdivide, keep his house, and then sell off the rest for whatever? And that's kind of what I've seen in some of the lots around here.
But I'm not required to. That's the point.
Yeah.
I don't want to be required to.
Yeah.
So I think everyone understands the motion. We're going to vote on the language that gives the direction to the Planning Commission. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Okay, motion carries 6-0. Okay, thank you, Yuri.
Thank you.
And the Planning Commission, we will await their action. Probably have scared Mr. Cornwell off. Mayor reports. Okay, Council, this Sunday is the Tunnel to Towers run, September 11th, 8:30 to 3:30 in Tyner Park. They're still looking for volunteers. It's a great event. I urge you to go on and look for it. I'll give you a quick example of, well, you've spent more meetings. Why don't you tell me quickly about what the Tunnel to Towers run
is? Yeah, the Tunnel to Towers started in New York City in honor of Stephen Siller, a firefighter who ran approximately 5K, about 3.1 miles, through a bridge and tunnel because he got stuck in Brooklyn Battery Tunnel in his vehicle. Everyone was trying to get away. He ran with all of his gear on to the towers to save people, lost his life. Since then, there's the 5K run walk every year in New York. This year, for the 10th anniversary, the goal is to get 343 jurisdictions nationwide to hold a similar event in honor of the 343 first responders who lost their lives. And so there's been a wonderful group of people, a young woman named Crystal Staple, as well as Welcome 7 firefighters who have been coordinating this event. They've done a significant vast majority of all of this. I've helped a little bit with public relations on this, doing some graphics, getting the word out to the media and the public. But they've done a sizable amount. They came up with the route. They've brought in some local dignitaries. County Executive Pete Kremen will be there. 42nd Legislative District Representative Fitz Bies will be there. It's a run walk as well as a memorial. The memorial's at noon, the moment of silence, honor guard, and all that. The money goes to helping send one of the firefighters from that unit to New York to run in the full anniversary commemoration in New York, as well as to help support local first responder efforts.
Yeah, great program.
So this Sunday, 8:30 to 3:30, they need volunteers different times during the day. If you want to sign up, Kim at the Fresno Police Department would help you, or just come and observe the event.
Is it in Pioneer Park or where in the park?
Mainly it'll be finishing right in between the library and the Boys and Girls Club on the grass there. That's where they'll set up some portable bleachers and to have the event. So Sunday, 8:30, they'll be serving some food, some hot dogs and things. So.
And I feel for these guys because Sunday's forecast is 88 degrees.
That's okay.
They'll lose a couple.
And Imhoff will be open for their run. Very significant. Okay. I sent you an email on it, but I want to just mention it again. The Ferndale Community Garden, if you get a chance, drive by. There were some people who was worried about a deer fence. The deer fence is up. It's working. They're pleased. Community Garden is ecstatic. It's keeping the deer out. And mainly effort by one of our employees, Jim Slaughter, who worked on the weekend on his own time. Great job. Contribution from local churches. Finished out the contribution, so all the funds were paid for. Great community effort of kind of putting some people together between the churches and our employees, so great deal. The other one is Corral Park, and Corral Park is a great story. Is their homeowners association called us and said, we'd really like to paint all the curbs in our development, and we'd like to paint the crosswalks because the paint's kind of fading, and we need you to do that. So the response back from the mayor was, well, we don't have staff to do that, the budget's tight. If we provide you the paint and brushes, why don't you do it yourself? And they did a great thing, got all the paint. It's perfect. It's a wonderful example of people helping out our city and doing volunteer effort. It worked really well. Our public works crew thought it was a very good, lean idea.
Awesome.
And they were very polite about, you know, getting that response from me, so it worked out well. Council reports. Councilperson Hansen.
Well, I will report on the hot dog stand only to the extent that we know that we took in between $700 and $800 gross more than we did last year. And last year was a record by over $1,000. So the problem is that some of the food donations didn't materialize like they have in the past. And we may be almost exactly the same amount of money raised, which was around $3,000. So as you all know, especially those of you who work, we keep pumping that this is going to the downtown Christmas lights. So when Thanksgiving gets here and they all go up and we're all brightly lit, you could say that's the hot dog stand that did that.
Yay for hot dogs.
Yay for hot dogs.
Great deal. Councilperson
Ingram. I have a request to make, Mel, if you have room on your calendar on the 21st of September, you'll be back from Hawaii, I think.
Yep.
Would you be my fill-in for the WATCOM committee meeting?
Yeah, is that allowed?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It is allowed. Is it 1 o'clock on the 21st?
Okay.
Chief, can maybe you can
remind me?
Remind
me. Drive and play with the lights.
Yeah.
He never lets you drive though.
Wednesday. Yeah. He doesn't let me play with the switches and the thing either.
Yeah, he doesn't let you do the switches either.
And.
Can I turn the siren on while we're going?
And I will also say that the mayor did a stellar job on the griddle. kept trying to get me to go sit down. I kept telling him, but I got to go over there. If I'm not working here, I got to work over there. So I did. But you were there for a long time.
It was interesting, Council. It was very Friday night. We met a couple. I was taking a break on helping them put cheeseburgers, but it was a couple from Colorado, and I said, "Well, how did you end up at the Fernell Street Festival?" And they said, We went online and we're looking for the coolest place in the United States that was serviced because we can basically get a quick flight to Vegas, and then from Vegas you can fly cheap to anywhere. He says, so we were looking at how to fly to Vegas, and then we did, what's the coolest place in the United States? And Bellingham, yeah, temperature. So Bellingham, Whatcom County came up, so we came up with another couple.
Mm-hmm.
That was your only thing? I was, yeah, we just wanted to go to the coolest place in the nation.
Okay.
Like us going to the hottest place.
That's right.
In the middle of winter.
In the middle
yeah.
of winter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Mel was saying that.
we need to. We were Brent and I and me. We were telling that to the EDC. We got to market this.
Yeah. Yeah. But
three ladies Mel, from Palm Springs, Palm Desert, that area. The exact same thing. Yeah, we're just going north. It cooled off.
Mel was mentioning about the Christmas lights and the benefit that the hot dog stand does to the Christmas lights. But I will give Mel a heads up that. We're going to have to keep a thumb on it because the statement was made by the president of the Chamber of Commerce, not the director. But Ann Klein says, I'll tell you where that money's going to be spent.
We shall see.
Oh, well, I'll publicly say right now, if it goes for anything but Christmas lights, they won't have a hot dog stand next year. So.
All right.
How's that?
The gauntlet is laid down.
Dude.
Any other council reports? Any other council reports? No, seeing none. Okay.
Oh, one thing, Gary.
Yes.
We've got it all covered. I think all of you got my email that both Paul and I are going to be absent at next week's committee meeting. And with the cancellation of the library ad hoc committee meeting, it now appears that all of the committees have a full.
We will carry on without you.
I will be thinking about you.
We'll carry that burden with us. We will not be good.
No,
too bad for you. Okay. Staff reports. Treasurer.
Nothing.
City administrator.
Nothing.
Planning.
We got the public comments from the draft environmental impact statement. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yay for you. Clerk.
Nothing.
Public work.
You want us to give you a pass on that, huh?
Assistant clerk.
Our police department.
There's always one.
Assistant clerk. Okay, there you go. would entertain a motion to adjourn. Oh, that's right. We do have an executive session. We're going to discuss the police guild contract. We'll enter an executive session review our collective bargaining agreement with the police guild. The session is estimated to last about 15 minutes, after which time the council will reconvene. An open session and action on potential agreement may be taken. So we will take action. So, take everybody out. Thanks for coming. Nice to see you. Okay, we have a session. Entertain a motion on the police guild contract.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, motion carries 6-0.
Move adjourned.
Second.
Okay, motion adjourned. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. We are adjourned. 7:30.
With an executive session.
Your prediction of 11 o'clock.